This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Two American women were taken prisoner by the Iraqis during the Gulf War. One of them was my guest, Major Rhonda Cornum. She's a flight surgeon. On February 27, 1991, she was on a search and rescue mission in an Army Black Hawk helicopter. While flying close to the ground, the helicopter was shot down by Iraqis. Five of the eight people on the mission were killed in the crash. The injured survivors became POWs. Cornum's injuries were life-threatening, yet even before she received medical attention, she was sexually molested by an Iraqi guard. Major Cornum tells the story of her captivity in the new book, She Went to War. I asked Major Cornum to describe what she was thinking and feeling as her helicopter was fired on.
Like everyone else, I wondered what was going to happen. Luckily, when you're only flying 15 feet above the ground, you're only scared for about 10 seconds, and then you crash. I just wondered if I was going to die in this particular juncture.
Were you afraid of dying?
No, I really wasn't, because I was 36. I'd had a great life. I had done most of the things I thought were important, and I thought I was at least dying for a good cause.
What about, you know, having a husband and a daughter?
Well, I loved them, and I knew they'd be sad, and of course, later, you know, like the next week, I worried about that, but at the time, I knew they would be proud of me.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any memory of the plane crashing?
I remember impact, and that's all I remember. The next thing I remember, so obviously after that, it rolled and broke up, and I don't know what else happened, but the next thing I remember, everything had stopped. There was nothing moving, nothing making noise. It was just void.
Now, the way you describe it, when you came to and you were pinned down by a piece of the fuselage, you didn't feel any pain as you were regaining consciousness.
I just laid there, and I really thought maybe I was dead. I didn't know what being dead would feel like, and nothing hurt. You're right, I probably just couldn't, my brain wasn't working very well. But I saw a flame, and I decided, well, if I'm not dead, then I better move so this thing doesn't spread and I die in a post-crash fire. And if I am dead, I'll try to move and nothing will happen, then I'll know. And then, you know, as the seconds wore on and minutes wore on, I guess my brain got working better, and I pushed my way out from under this piece of stuff.
What was the reaction of the Iraqis who found you when they realized that you were a woman, which I don't think they realized right away?
Well, they didn't realize it right away, but when they took my flight, they took all my stuff off, took my gun, flak jacket, my flight vest, and they took my helmet off and long brown hair, and they pretty much realized then I was female. Other than a little flurry of high-volume Arabic, they didn't do anything at that time.
Mm-hmm. What were your injuries?
I broke both my arms between the elbow and the shoulder, so I couldn't use them at all. Blew out all the ligaments in my right knee, so I couldn't walk or pick up my leg very well. I could walk as long as it went in a straight line. Got shot, which I didn't realize at the time, but I knew I was really weak and dizzy and nauseated. So later I found out by various, you know, blood tests that I probably lost almost 50% of my blood volume.
Hmm.
Various other lacerations, cuts, bruises, and a broken finger.
And since you are a flight surgeon, you were trying to diagnose yourself the whole time.
Yeah, well, at first, unfortunately, I thought my arms had been severed. And I was really afraid that when they loosened up my flight suit wrists that my arms would fall off, and I really was afraid I wouldn't handle that very well. I was so happy to realize that they were still attached.
What made you think that they were severed?
Well, I'd been laying under this piece, and basically this piece of the wreck went right over my arms where they were broken, and I had seen that before. I had been in the emergency room one time when they brought in a guy who'd been run over by a truck, and they brought his legs in on one stretcher and him on the other, which that didn't bother me, but when it was myself having to look at that, I wasn't sure how well I would do.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the really excruciating moments in your book is when the Iraqis find you and they lift you out from under the fuselage by grabbing your arm and pulling.
Yeah, that was awful. That's what displaced my broken arm. That was absolutely awful. That was the single most painful moment of the entire week.
And you screamed. Did you feel bad for screaming?
Well, I felt like I wasn't in control when I screamed. I don't like to feel that way, but there was no choice. And luckily, they let go of my arm after they got me up, so it must have worked.
Yeah, right. It's like pain and screaming sometimes has a really practical function.
It really did.
Yeah, and I guess it did in that instance. Someone who survived the crash, as you did, was Sergeant Troy Dunlop, who was 20 years old. And you were taken together on a series of rides by your captors till you were finally taken to to the prison in which you were kept. On one of those rides, the guard sitting next to you put a blanket over you, unzipped your flight suit, and manually raped you. Is that an accurate description?
I suppose that's an accurate description. That is a much more dramatic description than I would use, but that certainly is accurate.
What would you say?
I would say manually molested, which seems to have much less emotional connotation.
Mm-hmm. Now, here you were bleeding, you were injured, you couldn't see out of one eye because it was swollen shut. You not only had the broken arms and everything, but one of your fingers was completely smashed. What went through your mind as some guys like fondling you and trying to sexually molest you while you're kind of like barely hanging on?
Yeah, I could have died pretty easily. I was really amazed that he would see me as a sex object at that point. My first thought when he started, I mean, and it wasn't just being molested. He started kissing me and kissing my neck, and I thought, he's got to be kidding that he thinks this is a turn-on. I was just amazed. I don't know else to say than that.
Well, I was amazed, too. I mean, you just wonder, like, what can go through somebody's mind that I mean...
I don't know, and he obviously, because when he did try to get my flight suit off, and he stopped when I did scream because it was excruciating, trying to pull this thing over my broken arms, so he wasn't doing it, I don't think, just to be brutal. I mean, I think he was doing it for his own sexual gratification, but for that to be gratifying, I thought was a remarkable thing.
As you know, some people have used this incident as an example of why women shouldn't be allowed in combat because they can be sexually molested, which would make them more vulnerable. How do you react to that?
Well, this was such, compared to the other things that happened, I just lost 5 crew members in a horrible wreck. I'd been shot and I'd had a lot of bones broken and wasn't sure I was going to make it. So what this guy did was really an insignificantly, in the hierarchy of things that could happen, that was really an insignificant event. It was just remarkably, I just was amazed he would do it, but it certainly didn't convince me, I shouldn't be here.
In your book, you say that your biggest fear wasn't being raped, but that Dunlop, the American survivor with you in the truck, would do something stupid to protect you and that he would get shot. So you were actually very worried about him, and you point out that you were 37, he was 20, which made you just about old enough to be his mother.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing was, you know, the New York Times reporter, Elaine Shalino, did a piece about you, and she called up him for a quote, and he said that he still thinks that women shouldn't be allowed in combat. And he said, "I worried about her all the time, and being a POW, going through the torture, the pain, you shouldn't also have to worry about what's happening to the female soldier." Did you know he felt that way?
No, I didn't know he felt that way at the time. But I'm not sure if it's in the New York Times piece, but certainly in an interview we did with Jane Pauley, she asked him, does he feel the same? And he said, yeah, I don't think women should go to combat. And he said, well, how about Major Cornum? And he said, yeah, I'll go to war with her anytime. So people can, by their experiences, certainly make exceptions for individuals, if not for a population.
Now, what's your attitude about men who feel that they're supposed to have a greater responsibility to women than they would to men? Do you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. I think that is a cultural thing, and I don't have any problem with that in our culture. I don't mind men opening the door for me. I always say thank you. I think that, yep, guys should stand up and give their seats to little old ladies to get on the bus, and I do that too. I think in the workplace, we should be treated as equals. I think the military is a profession.
Mm-hmm. So to someone like Sergeant Dunlop, you would say that he shouldn't feel that he has a special responsibility
I think training,
to a woman soldier, yeah.
Right, I think training would prevent that. Mm-hmm. Certainly in our unit, we didn't see men just flocking to hold guard positions when the women were assigned out there. The women took their 4 hours like everyone else did.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in Sergeant Dunlap's case, like all infantry guys, they don't have any infantry soldiers. They don't have any infantry officers. And so he's never had experience with women who've been trained to do the kinds of things he might have been trained to do.
Mm-hmm.
So for him to feel like they would be a handicap is a reasonable thing for him to feel, I think.
You were interrogated. I mean, it wasn't It wasn't a brutal interrogation, but, I mean, you were questioned.
Right.
How did you decide what you were going to answer and where you would draw the line?
Well, I knew about the code of conduct, which in general terms says you shouldn't do anything to hurt your fellow captors or to help the enemy. I basically decided that I would tell them the truth if it was obvious anyway. For example, what kind of helicopter were you in? Well, when my wrecked Blackhawk was sitting basically on top of this guy's bunker, it seemed pretty stupid to say I don't know. When asked what unit I was in, when I'm wearing a 229th patch, it seemed pretty obvious I could tell them I was in the 229th. I wasn't giving them any information that they wouldn't have already known. When asked where our unit was or where we were going, I wasn't going to tell them that.
You also didn't tell them that you were a mother. You told them you were married. But when they said, do you have any children, you said no.
Well, I thought that was important because I had some concerns about, first of all, concerns about terrorist groups. I didn't want anything to happen to her, and I had some concerns that they would use that information in a psychological way against me to get me to talk.
You were in an impossibly helpless situation when you were captured because your arms were both broken, so they were useless. You couldn't use them for anything, and if you moved them at all, you were in great pain. One of your legs was pretty useless.
I guess I was pretty useless.
Yeah. Well, you couldn't even get to the bathroom. You needed it very badly. You asked your captors to tell you where it is, and they let you use it, but you couldn't get out of your flight suit in order to be able to relieve yourself. So you were in this really kind of impossible and embarrassing position of having to rely on your male captors to unclothe you so that you could relieve yourself. I was just thinking, like, what a both absurd and awful position to be in.
Yeah, modesty kind of goes out the window when you're in that helpless a position. You just have to you look at your hierarchy of concerns, and modesty was no longer very high on that list.
But it's interesting that when you were finally able to communicate what you needed done, that, I mean, they did it, and they didn't try to take advantage of you while doing it.
No, they certainly didn't. They were very considerate. They had to slice my flight suit off me and peel it off, and they averted their eyes when I was naked and put a robe on top of me and then take me to the bathroom. They were actually pretty nice about it.
Mm-hmm. You know what I found interesting? You know sometimes when you really have a full bladder and all you can think of is, like, relief? And you think, oh, what a really petty, insignificant problem this is in the scheme of things. And I'm reading your book, and here you are just under the worst imaginable circumstances, right? Prisoner of war, broken bones all over the place. And you have a full bladder. And, like, that at that moment is just the most important thing to take care of.
It really is. You do not, you know, you don't want to burst your bladder. That's a medical emergency. And you don't want to live in a wet, smelly flight suit for the rest of your stay, which could be months. So, it takes on a life of its own, that problem.
You know, I was just reading in People magazine that you're planning to do a residency in urology, and I was really wondering if there was any connection.
No, I've wanted to do urology since I was a third-year medical student.
Okay. There's a moment in your book in which you describe the first time you saw yourself in a mirror after you crashed. Describe for us what you saw.
Well, I saw this pretty bedraggled-looking woman with two black eyes, hair that was matted, I was worried about beyond hope, dirt, blood everywhere. I really looked pretty awful. Then I really was amazed that anybody would have considered me a sex object.
Yeah, right.
But I was relieved. My nose wasn't broken. And usually when I wreck a horse or wreck a truck or something, my nose is the first to hit.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Major Rhonda Cornum, who spent 8 days as a prisoner of war during the Gulf War. And there's a new book about that experience called She Went to War. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Major Rhonda Cornum about her experience as a POW during the Gulf War. How were you released?
There was a prisoner exchange, and I think they brought the first 300 Iraqis back to Baghdad, and then they flew the 29 remaining prisoners out.
When did you allow yourself to really feel confident that you were getting out alive?
I felt confident when they announced that we were leaving Iraqi airspace and entering Saudi Arabian airspace. Up until then, I was really afraid that some little nest of anti-aircraft guys would see this big, fat, juicy Swissair jetliner and think, well, let's get them. So I felt wonderful when the guy said we're now in Saudi Arabian airspace.
How well have you recovered from your injuries?
I've really recovered all my physical capabilities, except my little finger. It's still stiff, but I can hold reins and I can operate. And everything else, I can run, I can do push-ups and chin-ups and all the things I'd like to do.
It's kind of remarkable.
Well, hard work and good surgery and good luck.
Do they have to reset your arms?
Well, they did reset them, and they put a rod in my left arm so that I could use it earlier. Mm-hmm. And they had to, they operated on my finger. And then about 6 weeks after all that, when my arms were good enough to work again, I got my knee repaired, so I'd had a reconstruction of my right knee.
Mm-hmm. There is a possibility now of renewed fighting in the Gulf. How would you feel about the possibility of being involved militarily with Iraq again?
Well, I have to tell you that there is a regulation that says returned prisoners of war can't go back to the same theater of operations that they were captured in. So none of the prisoners of war from the Gulf War are going to go back. If we had a war in a different part of the world, I would certainly be more than willing to go.
Mm-hmm. A thought that you had that you express in the book that really kind of surprised me, when you were taken captive, you had your ring around your neck with your dog tags, because you knew that if an arm or a hand is injured, there could be a lot of swelling, and it would be hard to get the ring off, and the ring might actually...
It could necrose off your finger, so I knew that was the wrong answer.
Yeah, right. So you had it around your neck instead of on your finger. And so when you were taken captive, they took your ring as well as your identification. And you were thinking that maybe your husband would be disappointed you hadn't swallowed the ring. Do you think that's really what he would have wanted you to do?
Well, I know that's what he would have wanted me to do if I could have. We had talked about if he had to eject, like over the ocean, and your fingers shrink in cold water, that he would... If he could, he would swallow his, and said, "Even if they find me dead, make sure you X-ray my stomach before you bury me. You'll get my ring back." So we had talked about it, and I knew that would be a right thing to do. With two broken arms, I couldn't get it off the chain. I couldn't do it. I knew he wouldn't be angry. I guess I was disappointed in myself. I don't know what I was. I was very sad that they took it. I was very angry they took it.
I realized that the symbolism that it would have had to swallow the ring, but wouldn't that have been potentially, like, really bad for you physically? You were going through so much. I mean, to have a foreign object like that might have had some, difficult to digest parts.
Oh, I wouldn't have been digested at all. I would have just probably stayed there. It actually, as long as I could swallow it without having it stuck in my esophagus, I would have been fine.
Really?
Yeah.
It's okay to keep a ring in your intestines?
Well, I don't recommend that to people with small children, but yeah, I probably would have been fine.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Major Rhonda Cornum, who was taken prisoner of war during the Gulf War, and there's a new book about that called She Went to War. I'm wondering if you think that one outcome of your experience as a prisoner of war was to show people, I don't mean an intentional outcome, but just one unintentional result, was to show people that a woman could take it. You know what I mean? That you can.
Oh, I think that's really true. That's a nice byproduct of an otherwise bad experience. I mean, I certainly wish that we had successfully launched in there, picked up this guy, and launched back. No one would have ever heard of me or the 229th Helicopter Battalion, but it would have been the best thing that could have happened. Unfortunately, that didn't occur. We lost five people on that mission, and I guess I'm grateful that something good came of it.
Mm-hmm. When you were in prison and had plenty of time to think, did you ever say to yourself, why did I do this? You know, why here I am a prisoner, my daughter is probably worried sick. Why did I leave her?
Well, I did worry about how was she dealing with that. I knew she'd be worried. I certainly didn't feel guilty about it. I think you need to make that decision about whether what you're doing is worth the disadvantages, and that's certainly being separated from your family. You need to make that decision before you join the military, and I had made that one. So whether it's a foreign correspondent going off to some dangerous place or a non-combat position just going off to be deployed on an unaccompanied tour to Korea, you need to make that decision about whether separation is worth it, whether the benefits that you see in the military, the pride or the satisfaction or whatever it is, whether it's worth it to you. And if it isn't, then you probably shouldn't join, or you should put off having children.
It sounds like you really were able to not be overwhelmed by emotion.
Well, I think that's true. I think I'm pretty emotional, but I think I can compartmentalize well enough to be emotional when it's appropriate.
And being emotional is not appropriate when you're sitting in a prison.
Absolutely not. It's not helpful. I think being able to think clearly is important. It's just like when I get to a crash site of an aircraft. You have to take care of the people who are injured. You have to take care of the people who are dead. And that's not the time to question, you know, why did this happen? How horrible? I feel horrible for the families. When you're done with the job, yeah, you go home and you feel horrible about it, and you go to memorial services, you cry, but you have to compartmentalize those things until it's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. You know, I remember seeing the TV footage of you walking off the plane. Actually, there's even a picture of that on the cover of your book. And I think our listeners will remember you were walking off the plane. You couldn't salute because both of your arms were in slings and in casts and so on. What were you thinking as you walked off the plane and everybody was watching?
I was thinking how terribly embarrassing it would be to fall as I was coming down those stairs.
Oh, because your leg was
still
bummed.
Leg wasn't working. So I made sure there was somebody in front of me who would catch me if I fell. I didn't know how many people were out there, but there were an awful lot of cameras, and I thought how embarrassing it would be to fall into freedom.
Had you thought about the option of asking someone to support you as you were? It's not like you could really hold on to a banister.
No, I certainly couldn't. In fact, they asked me if I wanted like a wheelchair or something, and I said, "You got to be kidding me! I have walked all over Iraq. I'm not going to look like a wuss getting off this airplane."
But you didn't even want somebody walking down with you supporting you?
Well, there wasn't any room for that.
Uh-huh.
And there was nothing they could hold on to. If they held on to my arms, it hurt, and they could re-break them, so I wasn't going to have them do that. I'll take my chances with falling.
Right. Well, you didn't fall.
I did not fall, ever.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Major Rhonda Cornum. Her new book is She Went to War. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.